amazing irony in the weapon's demise, he reflects, the biological gaining revenge on the mechanical. This is the kind of lesson that might be heeded, if only by more imaginative minds.
Marvellous, he breathes,
observing the gathering pace of destruction. The luxury does not last long. Such flamboyant behaviour provokes a response, and already mainline attack ships are swivelling. Solus may not be the most assuming of vessels, a dreary hunk of grey-green matter amid a fleet of peacocks, but they know what it can do now.
Void shields back to full coverage, Vaux orders, returning to the throne. Pick up speed. Drop 2 points towards re-entry.
He is already thinking again, studying the intricate web of threats and counter-threats. He sees the remnants of the conveyor's escorts muster for yet another attack run, and their combined danger is considerable. He sees patterns emerge in constellations of larger vessels. The Blood Angels are here, and their strike cruisers are cutting through Kosalax's formations with impeccable void mastery. The balance of power still remains with the Despoilers' forces, and it is likely that planetfall will be achieved soon, but nothing is yet written into fate. Solus is getting battered. The tox dump trick cannot be pulled again, for the ship's innards are empty, so the next engagement will have to be of a more conventional kind. Standard ranged weapons, boarding actions, the cut of blade and bolter in the dark. Dragon will be happy about that. Rotwe is working well. They are pulling clear of the wreckage, carving a careful path. Kodad has the broadsides combining effectively. Now it is all about decisiveness, picking the right target. Vaux sees a ship plummeting fast to meet them from higher up in the sphere, piloted expertly, lean and blunt-edged. Its flanks are near black-grey, limned with silver. It is fresh from a kill of its own, and the straggling remains of a Thousand Suns frigate cling to its thruster trails. It is on an intercept course. Its flanks are burning, though not with impacts. Boarding pods have been launched, and its solid round batteries are gearing up for a salvo. For a second, he struggles to place the livery. It is Adeptus Astartes, that is clear, though the names and numbers elude him. Then he places it.
The Iron Shades, he says with relish. Come about! That is our target!
7. Castellans. Chapter 15. The skies were once slate-grey, made choppy by winds from the Keldar Sea, and piled with cloud. The rains would be hard and cold, angled steeply, and dashed against the dark rocks of a treacherous shore. Birds would wheel in those storms, thrown wildly. Men and women would look up and see the elemental fury of their home, and take quiet satisfaction. "This is a violent world," they would say. "So much the better for breeding the strong." Now the skies have no storms. The grey is gone, replaced by a dull red that strains the eyes and makes the heart beat too fast. The birds do not fly, but crouch, bewildered, in their high eyries. The waves beat thickly against the rocks, but no spray flies. All is sluggish now, dark in the lee, glimmering like old oil. Zirias no longer looks to the coast for inspiration. For years he made his meditations high above the north-facing Delos Gate, feeling the ice-sharp wind against his face. He would watch the physical storm and reflect on the metaphysical storm. None would disturb him in those times, not even a fellow battle-brother. For just a few minutes, immediately before dawn, he was alone with the elements. When the first of the world's suns rose, sending a long line of silver spreading across the broken horizon, making the wavetops glint like spear tips, he would close his eyes.
"As Ultramar, so the galaxy," he would say,
recounting the last words uttered, reportedly, from the lips of the Primarch himself to the first Chapter Master, before leaving distant Macrag. It had always been an ambitious goal, so far from the heart of power. The precise reasons for the exodus were long lost to the vagaries of time, though the intent was never doubted. Close to 10,000 years of service, unbroken, defiant, set right up against the borders of reality. Ultramar would never be remade here, on the fringes of the Eye itself, but a fraction of its resolve persisted, lodged deep. Worlds were raised and kept guarded, populations made orderly. The law came to the Sabbatine subsector and was nourished, putting down roots. Now Zidius only sees the end of that long story. In his darkest moments, he thinks of the line of chapter masters engraved on the basalt of the Hall of Honor, flickering by the light of oil taper candles. He thinks of his own name, Saimar Zidias, the very last. He thinks on the artisans who have chiseled those names, one after the other, centuries apart, but linked by that single thread of history. Mostly, defiance remains. He plans. He makes provision. He ensures that all around him is set right, and that the walls are still guarded. He does not allow doubt to enter his disciplined mind, certainly not despair. He remains, as he has ever been, efficient and active. But his name has no successors. It remains there, near the base of a single slab of stone, with empty space for more. That empty space is a rebuke. If he allowed it to, it would haunt him. Zidius strides along the corridor leading from the Gyges gate towards the inner keep. Dawn is still an hour away, and only the weakest red light bleeds through the narrow windows. It is bitterly cold, though his armor shields him from the worst. He has been armored, without respite, for months now. All of the remaining garrison have been, by his orders. He is weary to his core. His hands, locked away in those heavy gauntlets, hang by his side. To remain on his feet, to remain awake and alert, these are challenges now. Perhaps the loss of the Astronomicon is part of this. Perhaps they never truly realized just how profound the link was with the beacon, invisible to all but the psychers and the navigators, but somehow sensed. Its removal has done more than cripple shipping and supply routes. It has removed something essential and intangible, the great link to the throne world that they all, even the space marines, needed to feel. He must believe, in the absence of any proof, that Terra is still unconquered. He must believe that somewhere resistance is being mustered. He reaches the end of the corridor, where the doors stand open. Two guards bow low as he approaches. Chapter serfs in grey carapace armor and blue tabards. They make a decent show of looking alert, and their gear is in good condition, but Zidius can see the fatigue in their eyes. He pauses before crossing the threshold. He looks at them both. 19th Company, he says, observing the designations on their breasts and nodding. Rotated back from the Orvian exterior line. Well done. Well fought. They mumble thanks. The Emperor protects, Zidius says.
In eternal faith,
they both reply, making the Aquila. Then he moves on. He would like to spend more time with them, find out more from their own mouths about what they have seen out there, offer words of encouragement that might move beyond platitudes. But there is already so little time, and so many others who deserve his attention. The Praetorian squads have been well-trained and well-equipped. He must remember to trust what has been done here over the centuries to make these people strong. He enters a round chamber with slit windows set into the wall at regular intervals. The roof is domed and carries a fresco of the Primarch meeting the Emperor on Macrag. A long crack snakes from floor level to the apex, still unrepaired from the bombardment 3 weeks back. The floor is a dark, polished marble, and around the chamber rim sit columns with assorted battle honors set within shimmering force fields. A helm, a gladius, the tattered remnants of an old war standard. Atramo is there, in his deep blue librarian plate, the tallest and broadest of those assembled, save Zidius himself. Opposite him is Memnon, 4th Company captain, and the most senior of his surviving officers. Next in the semicircle is Tadakar, Praetorian Castellan commander, then cowled Diomada, mistress of Astropaths. Memnon's chaplain, Candred, has returned from fighting on the Bulwark Ridge, and his armor is stained dirt red. The acting master of the fleet, Landian, completes the makeshift command group, and is the most pitiable of all. He has no fleet left to command, just a couple of half-functional monitors at high anchor over the monastery's spires, and what remains of the chapter's atmospheric flyers. "My brothers," Zidius says, directing a perfunctory bow towards the Space Marines, then a brief acknowledgement of the two baseline humans.
"I will ask you, mistress, the same thing I ask at every dawn."
Diomardo smiles thinly, her eyeless face gaunt under a heavy cowl.
"And I shall give you the same answer, Lord. Nothing but screams."
Atramo grunts in agreement. He was a sour fellow even before this began.
"I begin to think this is no fleeting effect. I begin to think this is the way of things now."
He has been hit hardest of all by the change. The path of the librarian has always been strenuous, a test for the mind and the soul as much as the body. But now things are excruciating. Zidius has heard the cries of anguish from Atramo's cell in the deep of the night, and has had to order him to refrain from probing beyond the veil, unless in combat. As Diomardus says, it is nothing but screams now.
"The rules are broken," Atramo had told him,
months ago now, when it all changed.
"Everything I learned, studied, all gone."
That much became obvious soon enough. There can be no pretense about the demonic anymore, for they are seen in every street and over every cathedral, translucent and fighting hard for instantiation. When they make it, ripping themselves through folds in the air and the earth, the killing is unrestrained.
"And if this is eternal, we adjust to it," says Memnon sharply.
Those two are wearing at one another like ill-aligned wheels in a machine. Zidius instinctively sympathizes with his captain. Speculation is of no use, and the best must be made of things. But he feels his weakness acutely. The chapter has been taking damage for a long time. First, there was the disaster of the Boros Gate, the catastrophe that destroyed close to 5 whole companies, half the chapter's total. He had not been there, but had ceded operational command, as was the custom, to his counterpart, Chapter Master Titus Valens. Valens died in that bloodbath, replaced by his nominated successor, Rydian Artemenis. When the call for Cadia came, it was also Artemenis's place to answer. This was the way of the White Consuls, a chapter master to oversee the wars, a chapter master to keep the walls. Such a dual arrangement had many strengths, and it had enabled rapid recovery after Boros. As a result, the chapter was able to field 10 companies for the Grand Muster at Cadia, albeit at various levels of readiness for combat, and with the numerically weakest, the 4th, leaving much of its complement on Sabatine as a skeleton guard force. Zidius had come close to overriding precedent and demanding to lead the Cadian offensive. Artemenis was in most respects his junior, despite the formal equality of rank, and would surely not have resisted a direct injunction. The burning shame of Boros had played on Zidius's mind for years, and to lead the chapter into that greater battle would have been a way of making restitution. But the power of the law, in the end, was too great. Everything they had built on Sabatine had revolved around the law, both its spirit and its letter. To deny that now, when everything was racing towards oblivion with such terrifying speed, would have been a renunciation of it all. So he had stayed. He had watched almost the entire chapter's total strength make for the void. He had seen the fleet leave, its thrusters glowing white-blue on the run towards the Mandeville points. No one had been in any doubt that the situation at Cadia was critical, and so the bare minimum guard remained in the Sabatine's great monastery, 80 battle brothers, 30 of whom had been accelerated from service in the scouts, and 12 who were still in recovery from near-terminal wounds in other battles. 2 Castraferum dreadnoughts, Brother Argan and Brother Jeremias. 3 regiments of Sabatine Praetorians, totaling just under 7,000 troops, only a fifth of that sent with the fleet to Cadia. Auxiliary serfs, militia and standing urban defense forces, plus a token orbital presence. It had been a great risk. In normal times, such near-complete off-world deployment would never have been undertaken. But all knew the cost, should Cadia fall. As a chapter of the Astartes Praeses, it was the White Consul's most solemn duty to ensure that the guard on the Eye of Terror was maintained at all times. Most solemn duty. Zidius feels the accusation in those 3 words, and they bear down on him now like a physical burden. In the past, his chapter guarded an entire realm of far-flung worlds, sending guardians to administer and oversee them. Now, they cannot even master their own failing citadel.
"Report, if you please, Castellan Commander," he says.
Tadakar clears his throat.
"Controlled withdrawal from Kaldama and Bastion Tor continues according to schedule. Losses within anticipated parameters, and the garrison at Hartad evacuated almost intact. Last elements of the guard on Orvian are now beyond contact. The 15th Armored assumed lost. No reports from south of the 45th parallel. All zones there also assumed overrun. Acceptable control maintained across the three cities, though reports of incursion increase. Commissars have been stationed at all main gates as ordered."
It is a grim tally. Sabatine is an administrative center, a world studded with dense settlement and straggling urban hinterlands. For millennia, it has been as well-ordered and as peaceful as any imperial world could be. But the sudden surge of cult activity, fueled by the psychological shock of the Astronomicon failing, has proved impossible to contain. Once, demons were just rumors to these people, clamped down on by the priests and the inquisitors. Now all can witness them capering bloodily from spire to spire, grinning through their slaughter, and it has turned the minds of an entire planet. The rules are broken.
"In my judgment, the time has come," Zidius says. "We have responsibilities to this world, but when we can no longer exert control, we must guard our own. The fortress is too vulnerable."
Atramo nods, but Candred resists.
"We can hold the three cities," he urges. "The Imperial cult retains its strongest hold there. Just three squads would suffice to keep a lid on disorder."
"Just three squads," says Zidius, amused. "From which duties would you pull them, Candred?"
"As you said, Lord," Candred says, "we have responsibilities."
That is correct, and the reminder makes him wince. The White Consuls have always taken that seriously, nurturing the potential of the millions placed under their watch. Already, many citizens have been evacuated inside the monastery's high walls. Senior administrators, military staff, astropaths and priests. But capacity is limited, and now the halls are bursting.
"Your devotion to them is commendable, brother," Atramo says. "But we cannot disperse our strength any longer. The fortress must be fully guarded." "You have seen what they're doing to our people out there?"
Candred asks, a vein of anger in his controlled voice.
"I have seen it all," says Atramo, "more even than you."
Zidius is privy to counsel from Atramo that none other hears, and so the words ring both true and chill. Atramo says the warp is now spilling like floodwater over the entirety of the galaxy, drenching the void with its contamination. He says that the stars themselves are in pain, and that the laws of physics are being strained beyond tolerance. No ships cross those treacherous gulfs without taking catastrophic damage, and even the navigators cannot peer into that morass without losing their minds. No help will come from the void, Atramo says, for the only ones who traverse it now are already damned.
"I understand the argument," says Memnon, as ever in lockstep with his chaplain. "But the tactical squads can be recalled at a moment's notice. Better to keep them fighting than patrol the walls in idleness."
"It will not be idleness for long," Atramo says.
"That is the truth,"
says Diomada, who also experiences the horror more completely than most.
"Forgive me if this is speaking beyond my station, but you have already done more than duty demands. They are coming now. We all know it. Some of us feel it, and survival is the first duty of us all."
"The regiments can fight for a few more days," Tadakar says.
At first, Zidius thinks this is designed to put pressure on his decision, but then realizes what he means. They will sacrifice themselves to guard the withdrawal, just as they have been trained to do. That is yet another spike at his soul.
"There is no escaping it," Zidius says. "If any of those we sent to Cadia still live, they are far out of range.
We cannot even send our gene banks into the void. Such is the peril there. We have done what we can. Now we take to the walls.
Kandred tries a final time. They are fighting for us, Lord. They chant your name, and then they march out to die. We could march beside them, if we chose, for just a little longer.
Zidius turns to him and sees his scarred face, his dark eyes, his utter commitment. There is no insurrection in those words, just belief.
Kandred is an exemplary chaplain, fueled by the fire of faith.
For a moment, staring into that furnace, Zidius feels his own resolve tested. It has been too long since he took to the outer battlefield himself. But then the combead at his neck pulses, a priority burst from Gamond, the master of signals. He silently shunts it to his earpiece.
"Apologies, Lord," comes Gamond's crackling voice. "Two inbound markers detected. Hostile, battle cruiser class. Arrival within 6 hours. Orbital protocols, what remains of them, enacted."
Zidius smiles darkly. At least there are no more choices now.
"Argument noted, my brother," he says to Kandred, thinking of the slab of names and its empty terminus. "But we pull back to the walls. The fortress must stand, if all else is lost in darkness."
He feels the first stirrings of hyper-adrenaline, an automatic response triggered by the very thought of battle.
"This is a violent world," he thinks. "So much the better for breeding the strong."
Vigilia Carceris, the guarded peak, stands alone. The nearest conurbations are several hundred kilometers away, spread out across the fertile lowlands of the Mandua Depression. To the east of the urban zone, the land rises sharply, a folded country of glistening black rock. The only tracks through that hard country are narrow and impassable, except for the mechanized transports of the Chapter and the Praetorians. Eventually, the highlands surge further up into steep-flanked mountains, barred by grey snow and hounded by the salt-thick winds, until that ever-rising country meets the grey press of the wild ocean and drops again precipitously. At the land's extreme extent, the Oron Peninsula thrusts out far into the Keldar Sea, a spar of cliffs and jumbled peaks that soars hundreds of meters above the churning swell. Its sides are as sheer as spear shafts, striated with lines of ice and needled rock pinnacles. The air is thin across that high mass, and no trees grow across the slick, wet stone. This is the landscape used to prove the mettle of aspirants. They are tested against the chill, the weather violence, the driving wind. When the storms break across the cliffs, boiling up out of the endless grey ocean to smash into that spur of stone, it is as if the gods are hurling their fists at it in anger. The easternmost tip of the Oron would be a formidable defensive bastion, even if no citadel had ever been raised there. A high knuckle of solid bedrock, bordered on three sides by plummets to the white surf, jabbed imperiously out into the storm surge as a statement of immortal defiance. Over the millennia, though, the natural summit has been moulded and delved and hammered, eventually becoming a home fit for a chapter of the Adeptus Astartes. Its foundations were laid in the immediate aftermath of the Great Scouring, when a bruised and rebuilding Imperium still commanded the secrets of ancient manufacture. The vaults of Vigilia Carceris are cut deep into the naked rock, the walls raised high above it. Its outer curtain traces the lines of the cliffs, creating a bow wave of black adamantium that soars even higher, both proud and austere. Parapets are lined with defense lasers, inside which towers are raised, heavy-set, heavy-buttressed, overlooking one another to create close-packed fire lanes and kill zones. Jails, forges, and armories have been carved out in the dripping foundations, until the many chambers run into the hundreds, and an entire city emerges within those rock-cradled bastion walls. A fortress monastery is a gigantic thing. It houses tens of thousands, from the lowliest servitors to warriors only a step less capable than the space marines they serve. Every single battle brother of the chapter is enabled by an interlocking web of 100 attendants, all given their function to ensure that his weapons are blessed, his armor is maintained, his chambers are kept pristine, and his rites of devotion are accommodated. Cavernous hangars ring with a constant din of metalwork. Shuttle bays thrum with a ceaseless cycle of landing and launching. Immense reactors, buried deep in Sabatine's crust, provide power levels commensurate with a line battleship, driving huge void shield generators and fixed las cannon batteries. Every surface is engraved with warding sigils against corruption, and every battlement is patrolled by lethal sentinels. Great rock-crete stages stand under the spiked shadow of gunlines, the largest of which are capable of receiving regimental landers. Thunderhawks prowl like carrion crows above the high gates, arched and studded in the Gothic template so familiar across the sprawling territories of the throne. Virgilia Carceris has stood unbroken against every assault ever sent from the Eye's Edge. Aspirants from the Sabatine Protectorate worlds have been taken up inside its walls for millennia, a ceaseless supply of new blood for the chapter's never-ending wars, only to emerge again on white ships to sail the unquiet tides of the restless void. Now that movement is stilled. A few stragglers from its retreating armies race under the cover of the guns, trailing smog behind overworked turbines. Klaxons blare across the narrow courtyards, sending even the mute servitors trundling for cover. Searchlights scan and pool across the high towers, and void shields burst into gauzy hemispheres over the spire summits. The seas are no longer slate grey, but red, like a burst artery, and the crash of waves has been replaced by the echoing song of half-born demons. The western horizons are burning, marked by the battles along the perimeter of the three cities that cannot be won, for chaos has come to this world, unbound and infinite, and the tide of it now only flows one way. Soon the heavens are scored, scraped by long trails of fire. The clouds above the citadel flash wildly, lit from beyond. Comet trails sear down from the hidden heights, plunging through thunderheads to crash into distant seas. This is orbital wreckage. Sabatine's shattered defense satellites, plus the remains of the enemy vessels they took down before their destruction. In normal times, that grid would have been bolstered by hundreds of capable ships, and in their absence, the token defenses are taking a battering. It only takes a few hours before ordnance is scything through the flame-wreathed heavens, orbital lasers hurled from the undersides of great battleships, lime green and forge red. The beams smack into the hard ground and splinter from the cliff sides. Plumes of steam boil up from the shoreline, growing greater as yet more las strikes rain down. The rain becomes a deluge, a single massive column of coruscation that zips and roars, crashing over the void shields and spraying madly. Virgilia Carceris is lost behind a wall of fire, a thumping curtain that sends rock shards bouncing and foundations shaking. The fortress lets loose with its own defense lasers, and the inferno ramps up further. The air shakes with heat. The rocks begin to glow. This is the opening salvo, the softening up. While the guns of the citadel are fully occupied, their operators' zoom sights blazing with light and their shield generators shrieking with overload, the twin battleships are emptying out somewhere up above, their hangars streaming with lines of attack ships, their drop pod bays ejecting, their launch tunnels hurling landers along the rails and swinging out into the las-crossed void. Some landers are taken out by the remaining orbital defenses, blasted apart before they can duck into re-entry. Other vessels remain in the low void layer, going after those scraps of satellites and defense platforms in a hammer rain of hard round fire. Most, though, shoot straight down planetwards, spiraling through hails of beam shards, kindling re-entry fires of their own before they smash into the upracing world. As they emerge below the cloud layer, punching like bullets out into open air, gunners on the citadel walls unleash their first defensive volleys. Many incoming landers streak down far outside the gun's effective range, but a few foolhardy or misaimed pods stray into the kill zone and are blasted apart. The Oron Highlands are soon showered in blown ironwork, still burning from the descent, tumbling at high speed across the stone. The citadel is now shrouded in flame, doused in a void-hurled column that spits and smashes, turning the void shields white-hot and pushing them concave. The gouts of steam grow and merge and hiss up from the seas below, rearing high above the parapets. Return fire is overwhelmed, damped down by the volume of incoming ordnance from above. This gives greater cover to the landers, which are now falling freely across the peninsula. Drop pods slam down, throwing up smashed boulder fragments on impact. The doors cantilever open, thudding hard, and troops lumber out, carrying bolters and flamers. Larger pods make planetfall next, spewing forth the striding machine mountains of hellbrutes and other stalking, roaring, half-mechanical horrors. The biggest units, crowned with brass death heads and embossed armor plate, hit the earth in clouds of thrown smoke and grit. When their great doors swing open, corrupted tanks rumble down the ramps, rocking as their studded tracks grind against the crust of a new world to slaughter. Some of these are looted Astra Militarum vehicles, their armor marked with the octet and the sign of the god, and crewed by spine-clamped, limb-locked cultists. Others are the preserve of the legions, rhino transports in crimson livery and flaming braziers, or demon-bound crawlers with hunched spines and rust-streaked dozer blades. The pace of planetfall rises exponentially. Out of range of all but the largest of the Citadel's land guns, truly massive carriers wallow down, their thruster arrays kicking out columns of sooty flame. When their hatches crack open and the embarkation ramps telescope out, whole hordes of the lost and the damned charge out into the open. They are clad in scraps and armor fragments, snatches of Imperial military garb, and rags from the bilges of traitor warships. Some have no eyes, some obscenely bulging torsos. Those from the word-bearers' conveyors are cut and tattooed and marked with the ritual favor sigils of all four gods. Those from the lumpen hulls of Death Guard landers limp more slowly, dragging club feet through the smoldering dust. They grin as they advance, hoisting hook spears and stubber guns. They can't help grinning. All they do, all the time, those half-dead sloggers, is grin. The impacts keep on coming. Yet greater transports thunder earthwards, many hit hard on the descent, but able to absorb the strikes. They disgorge heavy artillery, demon engines with towers of bronze that hiss with steam, malice and agony. The dust and flame mingle, swirling, making their outlines hazy. Eye lenses glow in the miasma, and released bloat drones wobble through the murk, lone seeker lenses already whirring, and loft turbines buzzing. The tank squadrons grind ahead, angling long barrels to aim at the battlements. The outermost walls of Vigilia Carceris are already lost in a shaking gauze of heat and kicked-up dust, but their size is still apparent, a mountain of smooth, dark adamantium, solid amid the hammering inferno. Artillery units grind into position, hauled by chain gangs and slavering mutant ogrins. Pot-bellied mortar cauldrons are stoked for their ignition spikes, lined up in long ranks. The ground is breaking up, split by the weight of treads and hooves. Flying debris joins the steam and dust, mixing into a maelstrom that clogs lenses and silts up viewfinders. It is not just the physical that suffers, for the weft between worlds has already been ripped by Abaddon's rift, and it only takes this incipient violence, this mustering of energetic hatred, to yank it aside completely. So the demons come, spilling out of fleet dropships or jerking into reality from the curdled air. Little lords bounce and wriggle, shrieking with high-pitched glee, even as they're trodden on by the advancing, unbroken kill squads. Slack-bellied plague-bearers lurch out of the broom, swarming with bloatflies and dripping with butter-yellow bile. Other summoned horrors slide and jump in the broken light, creatures with bloody horned faces or stretched bestial limbs. A stench rolls ahead of them, one that catches in the throat and chokes with vomit. The cultists scream and go mad, running wildly from a mix of terror and elation. The noise is deafening, swollen by the engines and the war cries and the massed trample of armored boots. For a moment, a gust of the world's storm wind briefly pulls the walls of flame and dirt aside, and a glimpse of the Citadel flashes before them all, gaunt and ravaged and burned down to black. Faint lights shine along the parapets, and banners snap in the skirling tornado. The void shields are still in place, a ceiling of reactor-fed energy that resists the orbital barrage and sends it rolling in cataracts down the far cliff edges. There are walls within walls, towers ranked atop towers, all crammed with guns and defenders, and the stubborn pride of an Astartes Praeses chapter. An Aquila can be seen, etched in royal blue on a white ground. Then it is gone, blotted out, just another burning mountain amid the murk. The guns roll, the tanks drag, the ranks of traitor space marines begin the long haul under scything lines of fire. They are hungry, they are famished, and the feast has only just begun. Chapter 16. Time has already run out. Dragon is impatient, primed for battle, and yet still solace imprisons him. He strides down the dark ways, his shoulder guards scratching against the overhanging roofs, hunting. This far down, things would normally be crowded. Multitudes live down here, whole spawn families of the unchanged, eking out meager snatches of existence in the stink and the cold. He used to come down here with Slurt, who liked these places, and they would explore the farthest reaches together.
"This is where I do my best work,"
the putrefier had always said, grinning in the gloom.
"These people, incubators, all of them."
Dragon is moving faster now. The empty halls echo from the wet tread of his boots, for the inhabitants have been herded into landers and sent down to the surface. Some will not survive the journey. Many more will die before they get anywhere close to the walls, but they will each absorb a round or two before they do. That is the calculus in these things. A single round, manufactured at cost to the enemy, is of greater value than a human life, created without thought within a fertile sump of pointlessness. Dragon wonders if Vorx approves of that exchange, or whether all that cant about the god and their high purpose is just so much bilge fodder when the necessities of battle call. The signs are here, now. There is fresh blood on the walls, black and glimmering under the sweep of his helm lumens. He can smell the beginnings of the spore, machine oils fused with the oversweet stink of mutation. An hour ago, he heard noises, too. Big, echoing bangs, like iron beams being slammed into unyielding decking. This is another insult, this errand. A part of him almost refused, but to make the challenge now at this juncture feels wrong. There is already too much in motion, too many things he doesn't understand. There can be no argument with this battle, and so the only objective remaining is to play his part in it, to win glory in the eyes of the Unbroken, who are yet unpersuaded by his talents. That is the truest course, the patient one. Those who doubt him doubt his impetuosity, so he must demonstrate his ability to play the long game, too. The smell grows stronger. The copper taint of new slaying becomes intense. The bulkheads around him are slippery with fear. Dragon guesses that even before the Unchanged were rounded up and sent stumbling into their transports, they avoided this place. There are many monsters in the dark and the deep, but some are worse than others. He feels his knife slide against the puffy flesh of his killing hand. He does not draw his pistol with the other one. Such a weapon is of little use here. But he goes more warily, sensing closeness. These are gaping places, chambers that swell and resound, their ceilings lost in fly-thick clouds, their floors knee-deep in oily water. One day, he will understand the need for this grime and gunge. He will revel in it and see it as a badge of identity. He remembers what Typhus told him on the Terminus Est.
"He never let us clean the filth from our armor. Over time, we stopped wanting to."
That must be how it begins. First, you ignore it. Then you accept it. Then, finally, you are defined by it. He hears a sound, a faint, sunk down, hissed through such clogged oxygen arteries that respiration must surely be an impressive achievement. Dragon halts, taut as a hamstring, looking into the wall of darkness.
"Unsleeping,"
he calls out, and the word echoes from the columns and the vaults around him. For a long moment, punctuated only by the heavy drum of his heartbeats, nothing. Then, far off, at the end of this great hall, something moves. It is bigger, far bigger than it ought to be, even for one of its cursed kind. Solace is a fecund place, stuffed with rotting meats and nutrient-rich fluids, its airways viscous with the changing harmonics of the demonic. All things grow here, sucking in the fungoid and the decaying, slowly becoming just another tumor on the face of this withered ship corpse. The thing moves, shifting one massive leg, and Dragon sees the expanse of dark grey flesh spilling over the joints and cables. There is more of it than there was the last time. Every time it grows a little more. A pair of tiny eyes blink. Those eyes are the worst thing, sunk within a harrowed face, almost entirely lost behind a nest of rusted cabling. They are red, wholly bloodshot, with matte black irises. They do not focus well. They seem almost independent of one another, as if the mind controlling them has begun to lose the last grips of control.
"I do not know you,"
comes a voice from the gloom, high up, muffled by matted gunk over its gigantic vox emitters.
"You do, Naum," says Dragon,
holding his ground. It is rare that he is dwarfed by anything, but this mass of twisted organics and galaxy-old ceramite has become bloated beyond any reason. Towering, thrust out, as misshapen and ill-made as an infant's first scratchings at construction.
"We fought together, remember? On Urveb."
The eyes blink. Tears run down from them, pale and twinkling in the faint lumen flash. The creature shifts on its center of gravity, a fraction of movement that makes pistons sigh, and more of its face emerges into Dragon's helm beam. Naum's face structure is much as it must have been 10,000 years ago. The bone is visible in places where the last of the skin has flaked off, but there are sinews and gristles still clinging on, gilding the profile with a faint vestige of old humanity. On an Imperial Walker sarcophagus, that face would have been locked away, shielded by a frontal plate, as if embarrassed by the things they do to their fallen. Here, the faces are kept proudly on display, surrounded by a high collar and disfigured by the random insertion of gurgling pipework. All that remains of Naum of Barbarus cannot be forgotten, but becomes a badge of failure to look out once more on the battlefield.
"Urveb,"
Naum hisses. The voice is very soft, very deep, generated in worn-out boxes slung somewhere in that cavernous chest cavity and piped through clogged speaker mores.
"No. Hungry."
It takes another step, a single, heaving, hesitant step, and it is as if the entire wall before Dragon has detached and come swinging for him.
"We are above another world," Dragon says, avoiding the urge to speak faster. Naum will not be seeing any of this as he sees it. Even Vaux, his mind rotted by devotion, sees the world of the physical with more clarity than this one.
Naum blinks again. Lines of dry brown staining run down his chin, and there is a stray human finger there, dangling from his collar on a last thread of sinew.
"Am I asleep?" Naum asks.
"You know the answer to that," says Dragon patiently.
This wretch ought to be asleep. All of his kind ought to be chained down, locked away, dosed with soporifics and dream suppressants, only roused when their prodigious killing power is required. Others of his order do as they are supposed to, staving off complete madness through the blissful imposition of tranquilization, and only having to contend with the horror of living for those few brief hours of bloodletting. But Naum does not sleep. Something went wrong with him, and now he cannot. He has been awake for a long time, for more than 9,000 years, so they say. Given that, the fact that he can speak at all is something of a miracle. One sent from the god, no doubt.
Eat. You,
Naum says, licking bony lips with her black tongue. Dragan can see that he has been weeping a lot.
Make planet fall here, Naum, Dragan says calmly. The casket is waiting. Then you can eat all you like.
For a moment, Naum does not respond. He does not understand. His colossal body, with its growths and its metal struts and its swollen armor plates, shifts uneasily. Dragan wonders what on earth he must be experiencing. Existence on this ship is already like a dream, or a nightmare. For Naum, the boundary between states has long since ceased to exist. All that remains is a fog of pain, of sensations he no longer has names for. He is not visibly enraged and psychotic, as a hellbrute of Carnath might be, only obstinate.
Eat them,
Naum says at last, seeming to grasp something.
Yes, as many as you like, says Dragan again, feeling like a barrier has been broken.
There is endurance, that is known. Some feats within this legion make the mind turn, some expressions of that old capacity for resilience. But for this, there are no words. Not that Dragan knows, anyway. What is left in there to endure? What remnant of an old willpower still burns away, refusing the siren embrace of complete insanity? Condensation runs down Naum's outer shell. In the dark, he flexes power claws bigger than Dragan's whole body. Ancient bone shards click, rotting flay skirts rustle. The eyes blink, once, twice, squeezing tears down wrinkled, ash-dry flesh. Then the black gums are exposed, something like a smile, or the dream image of one, semi-remembered and blurred by the fog of being.
Show me, he says.
Night comes to Sabatine. This is the darkness of battle smog and burning wreckage, the pause over vehicle carcasses and gun emplacements, and it smothers the skies and engulfs the land. Slurt is there, along with his 6 battle squads of unbroken and hundreds of unchanged. The entire plain ahead of him is crawling, infantry masses and tank columns grinding and yammering under the flickering flame cover. It is hard to gauge numbers in the gloom and the movement, but there must be many tens of thousands of troops now engaged or moving to engage. Solus has landed almost all its unbroken, committing close to 600 to the battlefield. The Iamandar has landed, if anything more, and the Wordbearer's terror troops stalk through the drifting smog like dark crimson revenants. The Citadel has 2 land-facing gates, both encrusted with lascannons and overhung with defensive strongpoints. The Wordbearers are pushing towards the far gate on the northern flank of the battlefield, driving their armies of cultists straight into the fire lanes. It's brutal work, and they're losing hundreds. But the gap is closing, and now the mobile armor is beginning to find its mark. The orbital barrage has slowed now, cutting out as the invaders close in around the citadel in a huge swathe. It is replaced by a more targeted pattern of ranged fire, thumping volleys from the landed artillery lines and the first strafing rounds from the atmospheric gunships. The enemy has its own flyers, but these are kept close to the citadel's protective las cover, hovering virtually under the eaves of the towers within. The exchange of solid round fire is blistering, carving tracer lines through the hot dark and lighting up the parapets in flashes of impact.
By the god, they're weak now,
comes a familiar voice at Slurt's shoulder. He turns to see Garstag stomping up behind him, kitted out for the siege warfare to come. He carries his chainsword two-handed, and his lenses flare a soft pale green in the murk. 3 little lords cling one-handed to his pauldrons, swinging happily as the Cardane master swaggers.
They don't have the guns to clear the plain,
Garstag spits contemptuously.
Those walls won't hold long either.
Slurt shrugs, just as another arc of stony-to-artillery screams overhead to smash into the parapets beyond.
"Maybe, maybe," he says. "Stronger than they look, I would suppose. So are you here to grumble, Garstag, or to get that blade wet?"
Garstag growls. He does not have much of a sense of humor.
"Just get me inside."
Slurt goes back to what he was doing. His position is a few hundred meters back from the southern gate's causeway, and the terrain in between is now seething with marching plague walkers. Few unbroken march with them, for the rate of attrition from the wall-mounted gunnery is brutal. Even the Death Guard tanks are holding back, though the largest of the super-heavies are beginning to find ways to blast holes in the parapets. Slurt's position is behind a cluster of jutting rocks, out of the most direct lines of fire, but well within striking distance of the walls. The vantage is boiling with activity, gangs of servitors and cultists from Solace toiling away with hulking equipment brought down by dropships. Vats have been dragged into place, and are now chained together by tangled lengths of cabling. Most of the illumination comes from the dirty panes of armor glass, lime green and fervid orange, sweltering within the rusted-together tanks. Plumes of backlit steam gust from the seals, dribbling virulent toxins from every valve. These are big containers, the largest nearly the size of a nightwalker, and the servitor crews tending them are hundreds strong. Slurt looks it all over. It has taken a long time to assemble under constant fire, and 6 feeder tanks were lost on the way down. It would be good to have more time, a little more space. It would always be good to have more time.
"Enact it, then," he says grudgingly. "Let's see what this world is made of."
The order gets barked down the line. Unbroken guards shuffle back, shoving aside the dumb clusters of servitors. A plague-bearer demon, seemingly lost, shambles past, limping awkwardly as it blunders out in search of prey. Levers are thrown, dials are spun, great wheels are hauled by teams of bloat-bellied plague ogrins, and the whole chained-together contraption clangs like a hollow bell. Witchlight belches from the exhausts, followed by inky spurts of foul oil. Clattering generators rattle into life, and the boom, boom, boom of industrial pumps makes the ground drum. There's a cough, a scrape, and then the tubes slam taut. Noxious fluids burst down feeder lines, snaking through a dozen connectors before reaching hydrant mouths and bursting out in a foaming torrent. Some of Slurt's attendants are too slow and get caught up in the deluge. The screams are short-lived. Their bodies dissolve down to the bone in moments. This is more than acid. This is one of Slurt's special brews, one of his matter-eating broths that just keeps on chewing. It swills out across the cracked and broken terrain, gallons and gallons of it, and the stone splinters and squeals. Steam shrieks up, violent and outraged, as the broth pours down channels and burns its way in further. This is burrow flay, or rot rock, or matachu, a species of demonic solvent with only a little less than half a mind of its own. Once released, it will worm and wriggle its way into any weak point it finds, prizing it and thinning it and rending solid matter down to a gunge of semi-warp-shifted molecules. Already, it has gouged a smoking well into the landscape ahead of them, and it is carrying on, sliding down under the crust and into the veins of stone beneath. The clouds of green steam billow, and the landscape reels. Slurt nods towards the unbroken under his command, and they trudge after the retreating tide, splashing through the scummy liquid as it boils and chunters. How does this substance gnaw through solid rock, and yet leave ceramite alone? How does it know where to swirl and where to slither away from? How can it understand where Slurt wishes it to go and do as he bids? Just one of the wonders of the Empyrean, the great benisons of enchantment. All things are possible with the god, if one is willing to suffer in order to learn, and Slurt has suffered so very greatly to gain this knowledge. His warriors have turbo drills and macro hammers. Some have great encrusted shields for warding the worst of the slop, and others haul tracked earthworkers and delving claws. In their wake come servitors with bracing rods and scaffolds, and slave gangs dragging lumen cables. Where the burrow flay chews, they pile in, descending quickly until their shoulders are soon at ground level and falling fast. They wade through the dissolving earth, carving out the tunnels that are already bending towards the distant citadel walls. Soon they will be underground entirely, shielded from the enemy's guns, and following a subterranean path that will claw the very foundations of the walls from under their feet. Garstag grunts again. This is the closest he will ever get to issuing a compliment.
"How long?" he asks.
Slurt watches carefully. He has taken great care with the mix, and there are still things that can go wrong. But it is working thus far. Working well.
"Leave the gates to the fanatics,"
he says carefully, trying not to sound smug.
"You'll be inside that place within the hour."
Chapter 17. Vaux is walking towards the hangars. A little lord, the one he brought to Philemon to recover, waddles along beside him. Out of courtesy, Vaux slows his pace, allowing the puffing creature to accompany him to the Thunderhawk. Hololiths glimmer around him, glowing like traces of a ghostly spider's web. They show runes and trajectories and damage reports. They overlap, they shift and slide, and he absorbs them all. Nearly all of his forces are on the surface now, squeezing the citadel hard. He sees the vectors of his legion's few flyers as they pummel the outer walls. He sees the progress of tank groups, laying low the first level of defences before creeping forward. He watches the kill tallies click over and notes the names of his warriors who die. Lists will be drawn up when this is all over. The fighting has begun in earnest now. Breaches have been blasted into those ramparts, holes through which the twin legions pour. The volume of cultist troops is enormous, and demons come with them. Having overseen the assault plans, he must join them now. He must tear himself away from the ledgers and the scan logs and breathe the physoline acrid air of another world. He sees Philemon at the end of the corridor. The tallyman has little lords clustered all over him, clinging to his armour and his quills and his strings of counter-beads. Philemon looks flustered. He has had much to put in place for this assault, and only now will he join it.
"Enjoy this, brother," Vaux says.
Together they walk on down the corridor, surrounded by a scuttling mass of tiny bodies.
"You wished for hunting. Now you have it." "It was a warp kick," Philemon says, pulling at the hem of his cowl. "Something got into the pulse lines. An overload somewhere. We could have been atomized. We could have gone into a full shift, and now we'd be soul food for the Neverborn. We were in a gravity well. By the god, I still do not understand it." "You are not an engineer, Tallyman," Vaux says. "And now we are fighting. It can wait."
Philemon remains agitated.
"You know why they did it. You know why. They wanted us blown so far off course we couldn't follow the order." "A dangerous way to achieve that goal." "This is serious."
A little lord reaches up to Philemon's chin, and the tallyman, uncharacteristically, slaps it away.
"We were fighting then, too. We are all engaged. And someone knew. They knew that the beacon would be gone, and that we'd have to claw our way blind through the void. Who would know that, Vaux? What conversations were had before we left for Agrippina?" "You tell me, brother. Did you ask your demon?" "I plucked some more feathers. There's a shroud over this. We should be halfway to Ultramar by now."
Vaux looks at him as they walk. He wonders why the tallyman is so discomfited.
"There would be better ways to achieve that goal," he says. "Less dangerous ones. I think someone made a mistake." Garstag was seen in the Engenarium, Philemon says. We looked into the cultivator's memories, Count Quick and I. Garstag was down there. Why was he there? What business has the Cardane Master in the engines? Garstag. What business, eh?
Vaux wonders if this is just combat stims. Their bodies are not what they were centuries ago. Every engagement erodes them a little more. Their blood roars through weaker veins and